Danilana Kitchen talks about food. Danilana Kitchen talks recipes. Danilana Kitchen talks about lots of other things on community radio. Welcome to the Danilana Kitchen. My name is Lana Noctico.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
We get together here once a week at the community radio station here in downtown Ames, KHOI. And we get together around our kitchen table, talk about food, farming, recipes, advice, opinions. We talk about a lot of things. And we get by with a little help from our friends.
Oh, yes. The Donilana Kitchen Show is sponsored in part by Practical Farmers of Iowa, a member-based, farmer-led, nonprofit organization that has been strengthening farms and communities through farmer-led investigations and information sharing since 1985. You can find out more on their website, www.practicalfarmers.org.
Thank you to them. Thank you to you, our listeners. It has been winter recently. It'll get a little warm up now, but boy, we had a cold spell here, and I have a small story. It's a lovely story. It's a cat came back story. On December 15th, a friend's cat snuck out of the house, has been gone all this time during this terrible, terrible cold weather. And this is a old cat that has never been outside. Why George the black cat decided he had to go out over the winter holidays and spend these last coldest weeks in the center of Iowa outside, I do not know. We had given him up as a goner, as they say. But 2 days ago, George the cat came back. So,
well, either he was awfully stupid to leave or he was very clever to come home.
I certainly hope so. He'd never been outside before, and he's not really your young cat. He's kind of an old scrawny thing, but I'm sure he was ready to come back, and now I hope he's going to stay in for the rest of his lifetime, because he really was not supposed
to be.
I'm
sure he was welcomed back warmly.
Oh, yes, yes. So three cheers for George, the winter wandering cat. Donna, what did you do this weekend?
I had a lovely, lovely experience with my daughter and grandson and son-in-law. We went to one of those farm dinners at the Living History Museum on a very, very, very cold night. So I think we got the full treatment of what a Midwestern winter might have been like in the turn of last century in the 1900s. So this dinner, now anybody who does not know the Living History Farms, which is kind of just outside of Des Moines. It is, they have multiple, in the summer they're open everywhere, but they have different farms from different years and a whole little town. And it truly is, we are very lucky to have that institution because you can go and you can see what a baseball team looked like in the turn of the century and a blacksmith shop. And they actually do farm there with draft horses. And there's a turn of the century mansion, and it's several hundred acres where you actually can immerse yourself and your children. You know, it's education without the boredom. It's really fun.
Good.
So we went for this dinner. Normally they actually take you in a horse-drawn cart, but that night it was too cold for the horses to go out. That's how cold it was. So we actually had to drive in, but the meals are all cooked on the wood stove, the authentic period replicated piece. Everything was kerosene lighting. And when we actually went out to tour the barns and look at the animals, we each carried a kerosene lamp. And I'm going, oh, and the kids are, of course, swinging theirs all over and sitting them in the hay. And I'm going, oh, boy, oh, boy. But all went well. And it was a charming experience. And the food was quite good.
What did you have?
Well, you know, nothing terribly exciting. It's my feeling as I was eating was, this tastes exactly like my childhood.
Yes.
So even though I didn't grow up at the turn of the century, that was actually my parents and my grandparents, the food I was eating in my Midwestern childhood was very, very much the same. Like, for example, you know, a lot of things were canned. The pickles tasted just like my grandmother's pickles. The main dish was a roasted chicken with gravy, mashed potatoes, you know, all of the trimmings. And it was, you know, none of this instant mashed potato stuff. The young lady had been there for 9 hours actually cooking. There were 10 of us for the meal. So it was roast chicken, something called brandied carrots, which had butter and brandy and brown sugar and carrots in it. Another thing she called thresher green beans, which was canned green beans, but it did have bacon and onions in it. The highlight of the meal, and my grandson just wolfed these down, were the homemade yeasted buns.
Ooh.
Cooked in the wood-fired oven. They were, of course, fluffy, delightful. The butter was hand-churned and put into, and I have one of these things at home, a wooden mold, so it had a little floral decoration on top. Then what else did we have? Oh, coleslaw and pumpkin butter and strawberry butter, and then there was dessert. Now, there was an interesting thing. One was a chocolate cake, and she talked about how rare chocolate was and how pies, the other was a cherry pie, how pies were very ordinary. Of course, I don't think of pies as ordinary these days, but, you know, she says, oh, you can whip this up in 15 minutes, and it was a lard-based crust. Now, she made a cherry pie, and the seasoning in the cherry pie was very different. It was cinnamon and allspice. So I do love a cherry pie, but this was more, I have to say that the allspice particularly found that it covered the brightness of the cherry. So it didn't taste the way I expected
well,
it
right.
to.
We think of cherries as tasting like summer. This is
right.
more like tasting like Christmas.
No, it reminded me more of like my grandmother used to make these, and I hated them as a child, but as an adult, I really like them, a gingered preserved peach. That also always had cinnamon and clove and things like that. So pushed it more in that very spiced dimension.
Okay.
But
well,
the food was quite lovely because it was all homemade.
Oh, how lovely. You had a wonderful time.
We did. We did. And even the kids had a good time. Now, if you told them that we were going for a history lesson, I'm sure my 13-year-old would have been blah, blah, blah. But he had a great time. The animals were, of course, wonderful. There was that ginormous donkey, some beautiful draft horses. And pigs, of course. We took the slop out and fed the pigs, and my grandson and the other child that was at the table were going, oh, these pigs are really disgusting. And I said, well, that's where piggy comes from. Piggies at the trough. Piggies are dirty.
Well,
they like dirt.
They
are, like mud.
They're opportunists.
Absolutely, and they put on a great show for us. So the Living History Farm, one of my favorite places to go.
Good.
And in the winter, they do have some of these buildings are opened up and they do have these lovely dinners. Apparently the mansion is going to start having a 9-course dinner in March. I thought maybe Lana and I might have to go for this.
Yeah.
So this is the Living History Museum, just outside of Des Moines. Do go sometime. It was well worth it.
Oh, good. And food. Food is good.
Yeah. Food history.
On the Donna Lana Kitchen, we are going to venture into the world of fondue. We have a special guest. Everyone has a food story to tell, and to tell her story today, Ursula Rudenberg. Ursula Rudenberg knows something about fondue. Welcome to the kitchen, Ursula.
Thank you, Lana.
Well, you have a fondue sort of bit in your heritage. Why is fondue part of your heritage?
Well, this is kind of an interesting full circle experience right now to be on your show because my mother was Swiss.
Yeah.
My beautiful mother, Veronica. And when I was about 5 years old in the 1950s, we were on WYTV eating fondue.
You're kidding. How
in
nice.
In those days, that was considered good TV. And they actually filmed us sitting around the table eating fondue on WYTV.
And
those were the days.
Was that when your mother had a cheese store in Ames, right?
Later on, yes.
After
in the
that.
Starting
but,
yeah. in the 1980s, she had an import cheese store, and she did sell fondue packages there, and she sold the cheese that went into fondue. So, yes, my mother is Swiss. I was actually raised as a Swiss person. Swiss was my native language.
And German-Swiss.
German, Swiss German, yeah. And I spent about half of my childhood in Switzerland, the other half in Iowa.
Well, good. Well, we had the wonderful opportunity not just to have Ursula at the microphone here, but we have a pot. We're actually cooking here in the studio, and we will hold things up to the microphone so you can understand what's going on, too. Ursula, what do we have here? This is quite a production. You are going to make us a little bit of fondue.
I have to say, it smells really, really good. I have right in front of me a pot boiling away, and what is in it, Ursula?
Well, you may hear the rustle on the air. It's right now we're cooking wine, which is the base of fondue.
And it's bubbling away.
Bubbling
here.
Away, yeah.
And what's in it?
Before I start, I'll tell you the recipe. But I wanted to read to you an email that I got. I have a lot of friends in Switzerland.
Oh, good.
And this is an email from a Swiss person. Okay? She wrote to me, "On New Year's Eve, we had a wonderfully beautiful sunny weather. We went to the mountains to visit friends." She's from Basel, Switzerland, which is in the city. "And there was lots of snow." This is significant because Swiss people are feeling a lot of climate change anxiety because a great deal of the Swiss economy is based on tourism.
Skiing.
And climate change, actually snow is becoming rarer and rarer in the Swiss mountains, which is a problem economically. It also is very dangerous because it causes avalanches. Anyway.
All right, so, unstable snow.
Unstable snow. But anyway, she reports, "It was beautiful sunny weather with lots of snow. We took a small walk in the mountains while our friends went skiing. And in the evening, there was cheese fondue. And in the middle of the night, we toasted with champagne, looking down from high above onto the Lake of Lucerne."
Aww.
This is how Swiss people live.
I
wanted to read that to authenticate that, in fact, Swiss people still do eat fondue. They still do
and go to the mountains for snow.
So anyway, Donna, you asked about what's in this brew that's cooking right here.
Because it smells really good.
Okay, so what this here is about a cup of white wine per person. We did a recipe here for four people, so there's four cups of white wine in here, and it's a cheap, dry white wine.
Oh, and that's a good variety.
Right, don't put
cheap,
the good,
dry,
cheap,
white.
Dry
yeah, put
white
the good
wine
stuff in. Right.
And everybody has a lot of versions about what's the authentic Swiss fondue. In this wine, I put first I rubbed the pan with garlic clove, which was cut in half, so that the pan itself has a garlicky flavor, and I threw in a bunch of bits of garlic for flavor. I also threw in some paprika and oregano and nutmeg.
Oh, nutmeg. My goodness.
Just to give it a little bit of a flavor. And it has been kind of boiling away here, marinating.
This is what smells so good.
And this is what creates the base of the fondue.
Okay.
Good. I didn't realize it was so complicated. It's not just melted cheese. There is a base to this. This is good. And I noticed it has to be a pretty heavy pot because not only are you cooking things for a long time, but you'll be putting cheese and other things that can stick. So it has to be a pretty hefty pot.
Yeah, and there's you buy fondue sets that have the more authentic ones have burners with fondue fuel. The one we have is electric, which is also very common. And fondue is a peasant dish.
Ah.
It traditionally comes from the peasants who, in the winter, had cheese that had hardened up. And so this was a way of repurposing old cheese, melting it, and putting it over. It was a form of repurposing old, dry, hard food.
Those practical peasants. In Italy, the same thing happens. You save the heels of your Parmesan and always throw it into some pot somewhere.
Exactly.
Yeah. Oh, which brings us maybe to talk about the fact that besides snow and beautiful mountains and lakes and fondue, there are a lot of dairy interests there, a lot of cows.
Switzerland is a cow-centered culture traditionally. It's a cow-revering culture. If any of you have ever met a Swiss brown cow, you probably know why, because they are the most beautiful, gracious animals in the cow world possible.
Oh, yes.
They preside over the Swiss Alps, knowing full well their status. And the reason they know that is because every summer, as you know, Switzerland's a very small country. And it actually has filled out population-wise. It's full. So they have to go up. And they do have very high mountains. And so in the agricultural regions of Switzerland, in the mountains, what happens is that the land up on the mountain areas that is
the higher pastures.
The higher pastures, mm-hmm. they belong actually to the town. And then the cows that are essentially sent up to those areas for the summer, partly because there's not enough land below for grazing.
Well, it's also where the good grass is.
It's where the good grass is. It's also considered healthy for the cows to go
up
there.
The whole tradition is called alpinage, which means you go up the mountains, and as you're going up with the weather, the warmer, by the highest, most warm part of the season, you're obviously up at the top, and the pastures are fresh and green and wonderful. And in the history of alpinage, the tradition is the different kinds of grasses at different elevations create different flavors in the cheese.
No doubt.
So
no
you
doubt.
Make cheese as you go along, mm-hmm. and each different batch will taste differently according to what the cows are eating.
Oh, there's no doubt about that.
That's right, because these cows are not feedlot animals.
No,
they are happy out in the grass.
Right. In fact, taking the cows up to the mountains is a big production. It's part of the cow revering culture.
Oh.
The cows, as you know, cows are very hierarchical animals. So there's a head cow, and then there's lower statuses. The head cow gets the biggest bell. The cows know full well that bell
it's
size.
It's because they all follow her.
Right. Bell size is an indication to the cows of status.
Bell size.
The cow with the big bell is very proud. And the cows are adorned with wreaths of flowers and given crowns of flowers. And they are thus decorated. And then they promenade up to the mountains in a parade with the man who is assigned to take care of the cows in the winter or in the summer. These are called sens. This is their profession.
Sen, how do you spell that?
S-E-N-N.
Okay.
And they are essentially a form of nature lover, sens, because when they go up to the mountain, they essentially live without electricity. They get water from the river. It's a form of living out in nature. But their job is to take care of the cows, to milk them, to make cheese. Mm-hmm. It's a profession. And they walk up the mountain with the cows. There's also wagons. The dogs that have become so popular now in the United States, the Bernese dogs, their job is to pull the wagons.
Oh.
So they pull the wagons. If you want to make a Bernese dog happy, give it a wagon to pull. They love that. And then you also have some horses. You basically take everything up the mountain. So the cows are very, very conscious of their role in this. They love these mountain hikes.
And they know that the good grass is up there.
That's right. So
that's what they're going for.
You will see this in Switzerland happening, and it's a beautiful thing to see. And I remember watching it once in a Swiss village and noticed how the cow basically terrorized the cars in town by dominating the streets and kind of giving the cars long looks.
Right. You're not going to keep the cows away from that good grass.
Oh, how nice. Well, this probably makes really good-tasting cheese.
So if you walk around up in the mountains, you will encounter these cows, and they will look at you, and they regard you very kindly.
Very good. Well, I've always wondered what was going on behind that beautiful face of a brown Swiss cow. And, oh, what a history. What a history.
Yeah, they kind of have doe eyes.
Oh, they do. Yeah. They do. And we mentioned this happening in a village. So are these cows kind of more than one farmer? Is it kind of a communal thing?
All of the cows of the whole village go up with one sen. His job is to take care of everybody's cows.
He also
brings up goats.
Ah.
And sheep go very, very high up on the mountain. They go higher up.
Oh,
but you also will have goats and sheep with them.
Very good. And, well, do the Swiss make cheese out of that?
They do, yes. Well. And traditionally, they would keep the cheeses up there and then bring them down in the wagons. Today, you will see helicopters going up.
Oh, no. Oh, well. My vision just got ruined. Okay.
Okay, so maybe we should do the next step with this so our wine doesn't all cook down.
The next step is we're going to be adding
cornstarch.
Cornstarch.
Oh, really?
So what we're taking is 1 teaspoon of cornstarch per person. And Donna, you can explain why cornstarch is a binder. I don't actually know. But the job of the cornstarch is to bind the cheese to the wine.
Oh, okay.
And then with the cornstarch...
Now she's put that in a separate bowl.
Right, because you don't put the cornstarch right into the hot. You'll get nothing but globs.
Right, you do this separately.
Right.
So
in
with
a separate bowl, she's put the cornstarch in, and she's adding what? What are you adding?
This is Kirsch.
Kirsch
is Swiss cherry wine. And it's very expensive in the United States. It's, if you go to Switzerland, it's a good idea to buy Kirsch there. It's a lot cheaper.
Boy, she's putting a whole cup in. This is serious.
So the Kirsch is about half a cup per person. So I'm
good
putting
enough.
In.
That's a good.
I'm okay. Putting in 2 cups.
That, into the cornstarch.
I have learned to be pretty liberal with the Kirsch because the Kirsch is really has a lot to do with the flavor.
Absolutely.
Of the fondue. So it's expensive, but kind of worth it. So I put some in here. Now, you whisk that together really well so that it's well integrated. And
cherry-flavored brandy is what this bottle is calling it. And it's Italian, but
it's close.
Should be Swiss.
Closer than Iowa, for goodness sakes. Yeah.
Okay, so
So she's dissolving the cornstarch into the Kirsch.
And that sits in a separate bowl. Okay. Now we put the cheese in the wine.
Oh, okay.
And what we have here is a mixture, half and half, of Emmental and Gruyere cheese.
And it is grated.
And it is grated so that it'll melt quickly. You don't want to make it melt in the pot. That'll take forever. So, and they always say a figure eight stirring pattern.
Oh, my goodness.
Which you probably know about, Donna.
No, I don't.
It's a Swiss thing.
Okay, now, when I went to buy this cheese at a local cheese store in Ames, I got into a cultural altercation with the person selling cheese because I asked him what kind of cheese he had, and he said, Swiss cheese. And, and I said, oh, you mean Emmentaler? Because what we normally call Swiss cheese, which is the cheese with the hole in it, that is basically, that's Emmentaler cheese. Mm-hmm. And it comes from a valley in Switzerland called Emmental, very beautiful valley in the state of Bern, which is central Switzerland. But Americans don't acknowledge this, and this endlessly irritates the Swiss. So I kept saying to him, do you mean Emmentaler? And he said, no, Swiss cheese. So we got into an argument and finally realized we weren't going to get anywhere, so I let it go. But Emmentaler and Gruyere is a really, really great combination for fondue.
Ursula, does this look like it's thick enough?
Oh, that's what the...
It's not real thick. We could get more cheese and
put
more in.
That's what I'm thinking.
Okay.
Can you go get us some more cheese? This is not looking...
Yeah, we can put a little bit more cheese in. A lot of this is guesswork for me, but we're putting in about half a cup of cheese per person. But I think maybe we want to put in a little bit more.
Yeah, maybe twice that much even.
Emmentaler and Gruyere are cheeses where you kind of can't go wrong. If you make anything with Emmental and Gruyere, it's going to taste out
it's
of this
true.
World.
It's true.
You're also going to pay for it. You can use other cheeses. You can use raclette, which is also another Swiss cheese that has a whole dish onto itself. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You can use a cheese called Vacherin, which is also a Swiss cheese. You can throw about any cheese you want in. But if you want to taste really, really great, Emmentaler as Gruyere is the way to go.
Good. I probably wouldn't cheap out and do the cheese whiz route. No, that was a whole different thing. No.
Yeah.
Okay, good.
So we're adding a little bit more cheese because it's looking too thin.
Yep.
Well, while
Gruyere is a cheese that comes from a region of Switzerland called Gruyere. And it's in the French part of Switzerland.
I was going to say the French will claim that also.
That's probably good.
You think that's enough?
Yeah.
Okay.
And Gruyere has a a little village in the middle of it called Gruyere, which doesn't have any cars, and it has a wall around it. It's a medieval village, and it has a castle, and it's very beautiful. It sits on top of a kind of small mountain. Ooh. And is kind of a historical landmark.
Okay, but now, if one had to... Could the whole thing be made with what we call, in this country, Swiss cheese?
Which would be Emmentaler.
Yeah.
You could, yeah. Although, if most people know Gruyere cheese. And you know, like, how awesome Gruyere is. So it really, I would say of all the cheeses, Gruyere is the most classic element of fondue. So I would go with the Gruyere. So now, as you can see, the cheese is kind of
it's
like
melting.
Weird and globby in there.
Uh-huh.
So this is where we add the Kirsch and the...
The weird and
baking
globby
soda.
Stage.
Right. Mix it.
So that this is what's going to give it that nice consistency.
Okay,
it's going to bind
it
with
it. We have just poured in the Kirschwasser with the baking powder, not baking soda.
It's baking soda.
No, it's cornstarch.
Cornstarch.
Thank you. Boy, I would caution you all to look a recipe up before you try. We're talking about the technique here, but our recipe is... It's sketchy at best.
And I would wish to report on the smell here in the studio.
The recipe is really basic. You have some wine. You put some flavor in it. Then you add Gruyere and Emmental cheese.
Wait, and your flavor was paprika, garlic, and oregano.
And,
oregano.
Yes, garlic and oregano.
Not
and a little bit of nutmeg.
Oh, nutmeg, too.
Very good.
Is this really how it's supposed to look? That looks very watery. Is that right, Ursula?
Yeah. Actually, fondue is not that thick.
Okay.
Yeah. And as it cooks, it probably... While this is bubbling away, let's take a little yodeling break here. Ursula has brought in some traditional stuff. This is from a yodel club? Something?
Yodel club?
It's a yodel club from a region of Switzerland called Toggenburg, which is actually where my family has
very
a
good
house. And it's not the real high mountains, but it is the mountains. It's very close to Austria.
Good, good. You are listening to KHOI. This is the Donalana Kitchen. This is yodeling music as our cheese melts. We're talking about fondue today. This is Tasty Radio for the heart of Iowa.
Okay, Ursula, what is yodeling?
Okay, well, one of the things that, as we all know, yodeling is a form of falsetto singing. A number of you mentioned during the song that this sounded a little bit different than what you're used to. What we're more accustomed to is the kind of yodeling you hear from Tyrol and Germany, which is basically drinking music. But the Swiss generally don't use yodeling for drinking music. It's more of a traditional and religious kind of nature-worshipping activity. And so the Swiss yodeling is more pensive and more reverent. And I think
more
yodeling...
More dulcet.
Yeah. And yodeling is really was a form of communication. You're talking about people that lived in the mountains that, you know, didn't have a good way to talk to each other. So they yodeled because they would carry. And also the alphorns were a form of communication. There's basically a way to talk to each other over, you know, large distances.
Oh, yeah, the elk horns are those long, long horns mm-hmm. that are blown. We'll have a little bit of that music later.
So it's vocalizations right. that will carry long distances.
Right. And also that convey a sense of reverence. I mean, you are talking about people that live in one of the most beautiful places in the whole wide world. I mean, the Swiss people themselves will admit to you that their landscape can make you cry.
Aww.
And it has made me cry because it is so beautiful that it leaves you absolutely helpless.
Oh, how lovely.
And it's true. Anybody who's been to Switzerland, the caveat is that when you live in the mountains, you're in the fog most of the time. So those beautiful views that you see in the calendars are not seen that often by the Swiss people either.
Oh, very good.
Well, I like the explanation that it is a cow-worshipping culture. I have to say, so I grew up on in a dairy farming community from a Swiss-German family. Who brought a lot of their traditions over with them. So although we didn't do brown Swiss cows, we did Guernseys because that's what we had here in the New World. And even today, I have a collection at my house of cow pictures, cow trophies, cow ribbons, cow this, cow that.
Mm-hmm.
It's
a culture unto itself.
Absolutely.
So, actually, the cows that make the Gruyere cheese are not the Swiss brown. They're a black and white cow that is distinctive to Gruyere, that area of Switzerland.
Very good.
Mm. How is it, Donna? Donna has started.
It bubbled, and it thickened, and it's beautiful.
Mm.
The season, the spices that you put in there are just filling the studio now. Imagine, if you will, Donna with a piece of bread dipped in this
chewing
wonderful
away.
Stuff, getting it all over the microphone.
Right.
Oh, I think a couple.
I had to put a bib on.
For a Christmas show, I was wiping chocolate off of Donna. I think it's going to be wiping cheese off of Donna today. We're learning a lot about fondue.
It's just really good.
So let me finish up with what we did here. After we brought the cheese and the wine and the kirsch and the cornstarch together, the bread was cut up into cubes, which are maybe about an inch or two wide, just, you know, large enough for mouth size.
One bite, yes.
And what you want to use is a bread with a substantial crust and, you know, substantial substance to itself. A lot of Swiss people use day-old bread because it's a little bit...
It'll hold more, right.
And then if you don't want to go so heavy on the starch, we have some potatoes here. And you can also lightly steam various vegetables like broccoli, tomatoes are nice,
Ooh.
Raw tomatoes. And you can also use those. And then you have the fondue forks, which are forks with long handles. And you put the fondue in the middle of the table, and everybody kind of dips into the same pot. So it's a little bit like having a campfire on your dining room table.
Very good.
So you just, everybody gets a fork.
Mm-hmm.
And you put something on the fork, and then you dip into the fondue. So it's a very cheesy. This one is a little strong on the Kirschwasser.
Mm-hmm. Which is okay, because a lot of times what people do is they have a glass of kirsch on the table next to their plate, and they dip the bread in the kirsch before they put it in the cheese, because that has such an influence on the flavor.
All right, so Ursula, you taste this and tell us what you think of this particular rendition.
All right.
It has definitely more kirsch than I was expecting. What do you think?
Tastes like my mother did.
Oh!
Is that where the
tastes like fondue.
Yeah, was that where the recipe came from? Your mom?
Actually, my mother never gave me her recipe.
Ah.
This is a recipe that I kind of cobbled together, you know, from various experiences.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But this is pretty much the way fondue tastes.
Now, does the alcohol flavor burn off?
It does, bit by bit. And then... At the end of the meal, what you have is kind of the ultimate prize, which is the hardened, burned cheese at the bottom of the pan.
Oh, that's
which is
the good
scraped
stuff.
Off and eaten, yes, because that is out of this world.
Oh, my.
In a Swiss culture or any kind of fondue culture, is fondue sort of a celebration? It's a winter thing, or is it an anytime thing, or...?
It tends to be more winter because of the heaviness of the cheese, but actually it's not season specific. It was named the National Swiss Fondue Dish by guess who, the Swiss Cheese Association. So it is a dish which I think the Swiss very much identify with, along with raclette, which is another Swiss dish from the mountains. Is it eaten a lot in Switzerland? No, because it's not healthy, and most people, Swiss people, are not big and fat, and so it's a celebration dish.
It's a party food.
It is.
Very good. And since it's a party food, you remember you mentioned kirsch for this. If you had a gathering, what other things would you eat or drink or have with this fondue dish?
Well, normally you would have a glass of white wine to help you digest.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe a little bit of kirsch, which you dip your bread in and you also sip yourself.
So this is not part of the beer culture then at all?
No, this is not, no. Switzerland is not really beer culture.
Mm-hmm.
And also black tea is traditional, also because it helps with digestion. Because you are eating a lot of cheese here.
But it's your winter thing, and as you mentioned, it's a peasant dish, or traditionally something that came from making use of the bits left over or the old cheese that needed something done with. Yeah, that sounds very... You shared with me earlier in the week a very, very tongue-in-cheek video about making fondue. Here, watch this. And it was this little, very, very Swiss sort of feeling, little movie, little vignette about a man taking you through the steps, and he was very Swiss in a very Swiss chalet. And what was nice about it...
He had a whippet on the table.
As you said, it had a lot of cliches about the Swiss being very tidy and very...
Perfect.
Yes.
Is the word you're looking for.
I think of belt and suspenders sort of thing. Everything is taken, like the cheese was all wrapped twice. And yeah, and his explanations were very
specific
and big pauses in between to
right.
make sure it was the best part in the end was the dog jumping up on the table. Anyway, now that was very much a cliche, but actually seeing the picture of the little chalet, the house mm-hmm. that he went into. Yeah. Evidently, it was a cliche. It was fun to watch.
Well, it is very typical in actually what they had in that video, because the house he went into looked like a little shack
yes.
sitting in the mountains made of the most old kind
little
of...
log, wooden... Yeah,
like
very,
something
very
made
weathered.
And probably was made around in the 1400s.
Yeah.
But when you go inside, it is the epitome of elegance, which is very much how the Swiss live today. They really value and protect their traditional architecture and their traditional cultures. But within that context, they have developed a lifestyle of ultimate elegance and just beauty. And usually anybody who goes to Switzerland spends the first week just like dying of jealousy, because they realize how well some people are living. And
yes,
it is a perfectionistic culture.
Oh, very good.
Do you want me to tell you a little bit about the history of Switzerland?
Yes, please.
Yeah.
Just a few things. It is an alpine culture, essentially. The indigenous Swiss people, so to speak, were the Gauls, who are Celtic people. And they were from the Iron and the Roman periods, and they were absorbed by the Roman Empire. And the Raetians, I think is how you pronounce it. And these were alpine tribes.
R-A-C-I-A-N-S?
R-A-E-T-I-A-N-S.
Oh, okay.
And they were also became part of the Roman Empire and made up a disproportionate number of Roman soldiers. Contrary to what people think, Swiss people actually have had a very warlike culture
most of
their lives, and to this day maintain one of the most state-of-the-art armies in the world, which they never use, but they have it there. And in the late Middle Ages, around 1291, Switzerland separated itself from the Habsburg Empire, which it was under at that time.
Yeah.
I guess the death of the Emperor Rudolf of the Habsburg precipitated a lot of time of conflict, and the folks living up in the mountains in the Switzerland area, it's called Switzerland now, they decided they were tired of the conflict, and they held what is famous, which I think actually did happen, which was a meeting between the heads of three of the states that were in the area, called Uri, Schwyz, and Unterwalden. They met in a meadow, and they said, this stops here. and they formed a confederation, what they call the Confederation of Helvetia. Which is the real name of Switzerland, Confederation of Helvetia. Helvetia is a woman. She's a mountain woman. And, in fact, she's a mythical woman, but I'm not so sure she's mythical because I was once walking very high up in the Swiss mountains one day, and I think I met Helvetia. I came into a meadow of flowers.
First-person report. Oh, boy.
And this is true. This is a true story. I came into a meadow of flowers, and there was a woman sitting in the middle of the meadow, and she was about twice as large as a human-sized person. And she was wearing a low-cut white peasant blouse, which is not how Swiss women dress. And she had red hair and a big straw hat, and she was throwing flowers in her lap. And she looked at me, and she smiled, and I was so terrified, I ran away. Mm-hmm. I think that was Helvetia. This is a true story.
There you go.
I have no idea what that was up there in the mountains. But
I'm like not going to ask you any more questions about that story. Or
my friend, the Colombian shaman, says she was a nature diva. Mm-hmm. So maybe Helvetia is a nature diva. In any case, Switzerland is called the Confederation of Helvetia. It is a confederation, which means that it is a conglomeration of loosely governed states. They don't have one president. They have seven presidents who have basically a rotating chairmanship.
And three languages.
They have four languages,
Which and, are German, Swiss.
German, Swiss, Italian, and a language called Romansh, which is essentially a form of Latin that has been preserved.
German, French, and Italian, and Romansh?
Romansh, which is essentially Latin. And they've gone through great trouble to preserve that language. And anyway, as with most democracy, there's kind of a troubled history. During the French Revolution, they were occupied by the French and became a French client state. But in 1803, the Confederacy was restored. There was more conflict, and after kind of a civil war, finally in 1848, a constitution was written, which is usually the end of conflicts, and their constitution actually was taken after the American Constitution. They copied ours, and that was the end of it, and since then, Switzerland has thrived in peace and has this confederacy of Swiss states called cantons, which really are some of the oldest surviving republics in the world. So since then, Switzerland has remained a very vigilant army, but is a neutral country. It did not join the European Union, even though it's surrounded by the European Union. They did not want to give up the Swiss franc. They do have trade relations with the rest of Europe. But it's interesting, as a result of them not becoming an EU state, I have actually seen poverty for the first time in Switzerland because it did hurt their trade. Uh-huh. The other thing that hurt Switzerland was the rise of Japanese technology, because until then, Switzerland had a corner on precision technology.
Especially watches and things like that.
Yes. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. So they have basically lost that to the Japanese. And so more and more Switzerland has relied, among other things, on its tourist industry and its banking industry. It's famous for its banking industry.
And somehow it managed to remain neutral.
It has remained neutral.
During World War I and World War II.
It did make some pretty shady deals with the Third Reich, though, during World War II.
Whatever, it worked for them, didn't it?
It was basically what they told Germany was, you can use our bridges and tunnels to get through the Alps to go to Russia. But if you step outside, if you step a foot into Switzerland, we will blow up every single bridge and tunnel. And so what the Germans said is, we'll pick the Swiss up on our way back from Russia. Which, of course, the Swiss, they got the last laugh because everybody knew they weren't coming back from Russia. So, but today, if you go into a Swiss forest, you'll see like a barn, and then in front of the barn, you'll see there's no trees, and you go like, why are there no trees in front of this barn? And then if you look at the end of the tree line, there's a bridge, and you will realize that inside that barn is a cannon, is artillery, which is prepared to blow up that bridge. So to this day, they have armed the whole country, and you would not want to set foot inside of it.
Armed, but great restraint.
Mm. Good.
So this story I told you about the man meeting up on the meadow, that appears to be a true story. Mm-hmm. What is not a true story is Wilhelm Tell. Wilhelm Tell, with the shooting the arrow off of the head, he probably was not a real figure, But what he is a myth to stand for the guerrilla warfare that was waged after these guys decided to form a confederacy. Switzerland essentially became a guerrilla fighting country, and they chased the Habsburgs out of the mountains with people like Wilhelm Tell, who were essentially guerrilla fighters.
And things like that live on in stories. Stories are actually more important than probably Wilhelm Tell himself, if he was or wasn't, but that's good. You mentioned earlier something about a Elphorn. And I think we have
Horn?
Horn.
Those big horns.
Let's play a little bit of that noise. That was some Elphorn music from Switzerland. We are talking Swiss culture today, fondue, and good things in the kitchen. My goodness, it smells good in here. Our guest today is Ursel Rutenberg. I wanted to do this. Oh, and I want to mention this is KHOI, Community Radio, and this is the Donnell in the Kitchen. I wanted to do this kind of a program because recently Ursula cooked up a batch of this fine stuff for a New Year's get-together here at the community radio station, and it was a good time had by all. And, Ursula, I wanted to ask you, at that gathering, there was this wonderful cheese recipe that you made today, but there was another kind of fondue, another pot of stuff that things were cooked in. Can you tell us about that?
We had also meat fondue going. That's called fondue bourguignon, and it's not actually... It's eaten a lot now in Switzerland, but I think it was actually invented by a Swiss-French chef as kind of a new version of fondue. And we had three types of meat. We had deer, chicken, and beef. Mm-hmm. And what you do is it's really very, very simple. You just take some oil, like vegetable oil or canola oil. You heat it in a pot, and then you take these strips of beef and you dip the beef in and cook them. And the real work is in making the sauces. You make a lot of sauces to dip the meat in after you've cooked it.
So the meat starts out raw, and mm-hmm. you dip it in. So it's kind of like Chinese hot pot.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And then since then, people have branched off into all sorts of fondue, chocolate fondue. You know, the idea of melting something and dipping things in it has kind of branched out from there.
Oh, yes. That's very good. Gatherings. Around a fondue pot, it was just a really fun time. It was a real fun time. And also
It's very cheesy.
Very cheesy.
Very messy.
I love cheese. Also at that gathering, I brought something to share. Of course, everybody brought cookies and whatever.
Oh, my God, did you ever?
And every now and then you bring something to a potluck and people stop you, look you in the eye and say, can I have that recipe?
Absolutely.
This is one of those.
I'm going to say, the best fruitcake ever.
Mm. Okay. And I want to mention that this is a really good fruitcake for the winter holidays or any time. It's really, really rich. It doesn't have any booze in it at all. It's just basically honey, nuts, and and dried fruit. And even folks that say they don't like fruitcake will gobble this one up. It's called spicy fruitcake. And lucky you, this spicy fruitcake recipe is available on the Donna Lana Kitchen website. You can go to khoifm.org, find the Donna Lana Kitchen there. You can go through. There's archives. There's all kinds. There's a recipe page. Yes, there is. And you can find the spicy fruitcake recipe. And so all you people that cornered me and said, I want this recipe. I got this recipe originally from a book called Mediterranean, Over 300 Sun-Drenched Recipes, published in 1999, a big, pretty book. And I changed it quite a bit because I can never leave anything alone. So the spicy fruitcake recipe I have on the website has lots of spices, and you kind of pick your favorites: apricots, apples, papaya, raisins, dates, and I added walnuts and almonds. Anyway, the recipe
and,
is
and there's
there.
None of that glow-in-the-dark dried fruit
no,
in it.
No, you can use, like, stuff that's really good for you. Maybe that's why people like it. They think they're eating something good, which they are. Anyway, thanks to all the people that inspired me that said, could I please have that recipe? And here it is. Here it is. And I want to thank also... for many, many years, Ron Carson has been our webmaster to keep up the Donna Lana Kitchen webpage. But now, Gio Chalazzi has volunteered, and he's going to be dealing with putting up our shows and the recipes that we send him. So that'll be on the website. Yes, it will be. It's a good recipe. And it's a little bit of a fuss. Maybe the hardest thing about it is, be careful, because it calls for melting honey and sugar together, and it can get pretty hot. You're making kind of a hardball candy there, and you got to move fast.
Are you going to walk through us this recipe?
All right, here we go. Butter for greasing a pan. Cup walnuts, cup almonds. 1.5 cups roughly chopped mixed dried fruit. Use your favorites. 1/2 ground teaspoon coriander. Teaspoon cinnamon, 1/4 teaspoon cloves, 1/4 teaspoon nutmeg, 1/2 cup all-purpose flour, 1/2 cup honey, and 1 1/2 cups sugar. You grease an 8-inch round pan, and you can put in some parchment paper if you want to turn the fruitcake out later, and butter it.
And you butter the pan, butter the paper.
Pan. You butter the pan. And you mix all the dry ingredients, spices, and everything else in a bowl. Set aside in a small, heavy-bottom saucepan. Stir in the honey and sugar. Bring to a boil. Watch it so it doesn't go over the top there. About 4 to 5 minutes. Cook until the mixture reaches 280 degrees Fahrenheit on a candy thermometer, or until a small drop forms a hard ball when spooned into ice water. When it does that, then work quickly. Immediately pour your syrup into the dry ingredients. Stir well until everything is coated. Work fast and pour into the prepared pan. Dip a spoon in water and use the back of the spoon to press the cake in place, and bake for 55 minutes to an hour, depending on your oven. Cake will feel soft but will harden as it cools. Cool completely in the pan and then turn out onto a serving plate. And this keeps in the refrigerator for a long time. So make some. Take it to parties. It won't last long at a party.
I would even do something like this for Valentine's Day, because that's our next sweet holiday coming up.
Oh, good idea. Good idea.
And if you had to, you could drizzle it with chocolate when you're finished.
Good. Good. Thank you, Ursula Budenberg and her fondue pot, for joining us today. We learned a lot about cheese and fondue and the Swiss culture. You've been listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen. We'll go out with a little bit of accordion music by Dwight Lamb. We heard music from Switzerland brought. Thanks for sharing that today. You can go to khoifm.org, stream, download, archives. We have lots of stuff there. Support this fine radio station. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
We've had excellent engineering by Evan Taylor. Eat good food and enjoy life.